Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Amanda, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Updates in the Treatment of HER2-Positive Breast Cancer, and this is part one of our series on living with breast cancer. Today's program is one that I know many of you are interested in. There's going to be a lot of very interesting information on this program today, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as many, many other breast cancer organizations. So lots of resources for you as well that you have to get information from. Now, today's program, and because of that collaboration and your interest in this important topic, we have on the program today over 1,649 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Kenya, Korea, Lebanon, Tanzania, and the United Kingdom. So really from all over the world you are, and this is really a global call, and I really appreciate all of you being on the call today. Today's program was supported by a grant from Genentech, the Entertainment Industry Foundation, a contribution from Lilly, and Novartis Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support, but also for their partnership support and collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jen Rosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Medical Director, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Division Head, Hematology and Medical Oncology, the Cooper Health System, Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to present an overview of HER2-positive breast cancer, tailoring the treatment to your particular type of breast cancer, diagnostic testing, including staging, gradient hormone receptors, biomarkers, and prognostic testing, treatment options, including targeted therapy, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grana.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. What I'd like to talk about is early-stage breast cancer, our approach, talk about HER2-new testing, what it means and what's changing, and then talk about some of the drugs being used and the approach that we have to that patient population. So first of all, prognosis and treatment planning for an early-stage breast cancer really depend very much on the features of the cancer itself, and specifically features related to the patient, her age, her other health factors. Issues that we focus a lot on in deciding what the patient's prognosis and how we're going to treat that patient include the size of the tumor, the nodal status, if nodes are positive, how many. That also determines the amount of staging studies that you're going to do. In the past, when a woman was diagnosed with early stage breast cancer, you basically did CAT scans, bone scans, and we've gotten away from that unless the woman has a particularly high risk type of breast cancer. So bone scans and CAT scans are not routinely done for the majority of early stage breast cancers. In planning her treatment, other features that become very important are the estrogen receptor status, the progesterone receptor status, the HER2-new status, and in some settings, Ki-67. Some laboratories report that. It's actually a very interesting marker that can be used along with the other parameters I just talked about in deciding treatment. HER2-new was first identified in 1981. It's a protein that's expressed on the surface of tumor cells, and a small amount of this protein is also expressed in normal cells. So when we begin to think about some of the side effects of the drugs that we use to treat this kind of cancer, we also need to remember that normal cells also express some HER2-new. It is a member of a family of receptors, and this family of receptors interact with each other and with other receptors to alter the function of the cell. So it's not just one receptor functioning alone, but the interaction of that receptor with others. Overexpression or overabundance of the HER2-new protein is seen in anywhere up to 20 to 25% of breast cancer. And cancers that have that overexpression or that amplification have tended to be more aggressive biologically. In the past, we worried more about recurrence and also differences in risk of that recurrence. So these were looked at as more aggressive cancers. All of that, though, has changed with the advent of the HER2 new targeted drugs that we're going to talk about today. And what used to be considered some of the more aggressive cancers are now really thought of as some of the best cancers to treat because the response to drugs is so good and the number of available drugs is so great. Now, talking about the drugs that are available, there are a family of drugs that all target this pathway. That all target this family of receptors. Herceptin or trastuzumab is the oldest and the most well-studied of the family, but there are many others, Tykerb or TDM1 known as Kadcyla. Tykerb is an oral compound, Kadcyla is intravenous. We now have pertuzumab, neratinib, which you're going to hear about. All of these drugs are in various stages of testing and approval, and the goal is to look at studies that are combining these drugs with each other or with various chemotherapy or hormonal therapy agents so that the idea is that we'll have dual targeting. We'll be approaching that protein in a variety of ways to optimize the effectiveness of the drug. We now know that if you combine trastuzumab and pertuzumab, you do better than with each one alone. So again, tremendous excitement around the availability of drugs. The whole process begins with the testing process, and it's a bit confusing because when you hear about HER2 new testing, you hear about a variety of tests. You hear about IHC, which measures protein expression. You hear about FISH, which measures the actual gene amplification. And sometimes, despite doing IHC testing and FISH testing, you still come away with an equivocal or uncertain result. And we now have some more tests that we can do in that situation to try to pinpoint whether a woman is truly positive or not. There are also some interesting studies that are looking to see whether this family of drugs, whether Herceptin in particular, may actually offer benefit to early-stage breast cancer, even if the woman is only slightly amplified, HER2 new 1+ or 2+. So again, much more to come as we look at this, but the whole testing process can be difficult for patients to get a handle on. So once you have the test, the second question becomes, what do you do with the results? And let's talk a little bit about early-stage breast cancer. Let's talk about what to do after a woman has had her definitive surgery. She has had a lumpectomy and axillary sampling, or she has had a mastectomy, and she is HER2 new positive. Several studies have shown an improvement in survival when Herceptin was added to chemotherapy. But many regimens have been looked at, so there's not one perfect regimen. Various regimens have all been looked at. What is known is that you can do Adriamycin and Cytoxan, followed by Taxol and Herceptin. You can do Taxotere, Carboplatinum and Herceptin. You can do, as per Dana-Farber, Taxol and Herceptin, which is a particularly nice regimen for lower risk disease, or a variety of combinations. The key seems to be taking Herceptin for 1 year. A study looking at 2 years did not show additional benefit. So the key is using chemotherapy for these patients and using Herceptin for 1 year. But again, there are lots of options, and the options that are chosen vary based on the features of the cancer, the health of the patient, whether the patient has cardiac factors. There are some patients that we will not give Herceptin to because they have poor cardiac health, their heart function is not normal. In those cases, you don't want to use Herceptin. You may choose one regimen over another if the cancer is bigger, node positive, or not. So clearly, the discussion is an important one between the patient and her physician. Next, there's a whole discussion of what to do with a woman who may present with a larger cancer, hasn't had her surgery yet, and the thought is that you want to try to avoid a mastectomy or you want to make a lumpectomy easier, and there's the whole concept of preoperative chemotherapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. That's a situation in which chemotherapy with Herceptin can be utilized. And now we have data that adding pertuzumab or Perjeta may increase the number of patients who at the time of surgery have no disease in their breast or axilla, what is known as a pathologic complete response. So I'm seeing an increasing number of patients where we do preoperative chemotherapy. We use pertuzumab in combination with Herceptin to achieve that type of optimal response. There are lots of ongoing studies in early stage breast cancer. They're looking at Perjeta. They're looking at Kadcyla. You'll hear more about vaccines. I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. What about in an even earlier type of disease, ductal carcinoma in situ? There's actually a study that was completed looking at radiation with two doses of Herceptin. We don't have any data yet. This is not something that anybody's doing as the standard of care, but more research will help us. And then in women with advanced disease, there is a tremendous amount of work being done looking at various combinations of these drugs, combinations of these drugs with chemotherapy or with hormonal therapy, and combination of several of these targeted compounds together. So I think the message for today is that it's a very exciting time to be taking care of women with HER2-new positive disease, because of the advances that have been made, but also because of the research that's ongoing that will likely change what we do in the future. Now, the next thing that I was asked to address briefly is communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. I think this is a very important issue. There are many ways to treat early stage breast cancer, and the right treatment often is one that includes, involves the woman, her wishes, the toxicity she's willing to deal with, and her concerns overall. So that discussion between the patient and the healthcare team is critical in terms of putting together a treatment plan that is right for her. For some women, loss of hair is the ultimately devastating thing, and you look for regimens that may try to avoid that. For other women, intravenous chemotherapy is more difficult, and you look for oral options. It isn't always possible to do that, but again, if you don't communicate, you may not know whether there are other options. I think it's also particularly important that you communicate with your healthcare team as you're having toxicity from these various treatments. As we combine Herceptin and Perjeta, we're seeing a fair amount of GI toxicity, and it's really critical that you notify your team if you're having diarrhea, if you're having toxicity, because the only way your team is going to know that they need to intervene, that they need to change doses, that they need to give you IV fluids, et cetera, is if they know that you're having these concerns. So to me, that communication is important both in selecting treatment options, both chemotherapy, hormone therapy, and even surgery, but also in terms of managing the toxicity associated with our drugs. As we look at advanced breast cancer, that communication is even more important because, again, it's critical that you have a sense with your team of what your priorities are. So with that, I think I'm going to stop, and we'll come back and answer questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grala. Very comprehensive and outstanding. Thank you so much information, and I know that there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Shapira is going to address new treatment approaches for HER2-positive breast cancer, clinical trials, investigational new drugs and clinical trials for HER2-positive breast cancer, practical tips to manage treatment side effects, and key questions to discuss during an office visit or between appointments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Thank you so much, and it's really a pleasure to be with all of you, and always great to follow Jenny. I could listen to her for days. So let me start by going over some of the key principles and the drugs that we already have and are approved for treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer. Trastuzumab is our old friend, also known as Herceptin. It's approved for treatment of both advanced breast cancer and adjuvant therapy, And as Dr. Grana just told us, in the adjuvant setting, we have good solid proof that 1 year of treatment in combination with chemotherapy and other cancer-modifying drugs is the standard. For metastatic cancer, trastuzumab is typically given also in combination with different kinds of agents, and the duration of treatment is open. It's typically given sometimes in with different chemotherapeutic agents in succession, so it's less clear just how long one will be treated. There are now new options, pertuzumab or Perjeta, as been mentioned before. It can be given prior to surgery at the time of first diagnosis in combination with chemotherapy and trastuzumab, and it can also be used in the metastatic setting with very, very convincing data also from clinical trials showing that there is a benefit to combining two different agents, in this case pertuzumab and trastuzumab plus chemotherapy. In other words, more anti-HER2 drugs seem to give better results. We have more options as well. Lapatinib or Tykerb is a drug that is available as a pill, and that is an incredibly convenient option for many patients. It's portable treatment in combination with also an oral chemotherapy drug called capecitabine or Xeloda. So this form of portable chemo plus HER2-targeted therapy can be very useful for women who have metastatic breast cancer, who already have been treated with trastuzumab or Herceptin and have progressed or advanced in that setting. These patients often have very good benefits from this combination, and certainly from the literature and from my own practice, having done this for many years, I can vouch for the fact that many patients get, you know, many months to almost sometimes a small number of years of benefit from this combination. Lapatinib or Tykerb can also be combined with aromatase inhibitors, hormonally active agents for women who have HER2-positive metastatic cancer that is also hormonally sensitive. So as you can begin to tell, what we're doing is combining different agents, trying to think about what drives that particular tumor to grow, and sort of shutting off, if you will, or inhibit all of the different pathways that could allow the tumor to grow and thrive so that, in fact, we keep it under control. The newest kid on the block and the one that most of us consider our favorite is T-DM1 or Kadcyla. It's an intravenous drug, and it has some chemotherapy, but doesn't have the toxicity of chemotherapy. It's tremendously effective, and it has been approved in the metastatic setting and is actively being studied in the adjuvant setting. In fact, there's a study going on right now called the ATTEMPT trial, where T-DM1 is compared with paclitaxel, known as Taxol, and Herceptin for women with early-stage disease. So this is a drug that we are using more and more, studying more and more, and will hopefully continue to help many more patients in the future. So what's new and what's exciting? Well, there's a drug that's oral, similar to Tykerb, lapatinib, called neratinib, and Dr. Grana referred to that, that has been studied by investigators in many different settings. In the adjuvant setting, it seems to be very promising, and I think in months to come, we will hopefully hear more about the trials, because at the moment, the signal seems to be that it is a very useful drug. It can lead to diarrhea, and one of the main challenges for those involved in clinical trials and as we go forward with this drug will be to find ways of allowing women to hopefully benefit from this drug but without being excessively uncomfortable. Then there are other approaches to this disease. One of the areas that we are very excited about is sort of thinking about how we can harness the power of our own immune system to help fight the disease. We know from recent scientific studies that actually finding lymphocytes in the tumors at the time of diagnosis in patients who have HER2-positive disease seems to confer better prognosis, and it may be that it is sort of the right setting for drugs like Herceptin to work. So it may not come as a surprise to you then that investigators all over are looking for ways of finding a way to make the body recognize these HER2 and stimulate an immune response. There are some studies being done with a particular infectious agent called Listeria, where they have inserted the HER2 antigens and found a way of making that Listeria non-toxic for humans and able to deliver it as a vaccine, hoping to stimulate the body's own response. This is in very early phases of clinical trials, but it is something that we can all be excited about, and hopefully we'll hear more about the future, whether if it's this molecule or something like it. Another possible area for research is that since we heard that HER2 involves a family of receptors, perhaps developing some form of combination therapy that targets not just HER2 but HER3 could also lead to good responses. This has been tried. There's not much that I can tell you right now in terms of a specific drug, but these are all the kinds of things that are being tested currently in the laboratory. There's also excitement about combining HER2 agents with those that target a PI3K, which is a molecule we've talked about in other conferences. So what I want to leave you with is the idea that we are trying to find ways of targeting the HER2 by combining available drugs and developing new drugs that can be either oral or injected, that combine principles of immune therapy or perhaps also of combining different treatments that attack other pathways for those women who have tumors that are both hormonally and HER2 positive. So there's going to be a tremendous amount that we're going to learn in the next few months and years of drugs that are already in the pipeline, and I'm sure there will be many more to come. So let me turn my attention now to the other two aspects that Dr. Messner asked me to address. The first was to give you some practical tips to manage treatment side effects. And, you know, this is also a very important area of research. We are, believe me, very mindful of the fact that all of these treatments often take a real toll, physical toll, emotional toll. So we are just as invested in finding ways of minimizing or palliating these harmful effects. Lowering of blood counts and causing anemia, and with that, fatigue has always been a problem, and there certainly are ways of addressing that depending on the severity, but that's something to bear in mind. We hear about women who tell us they have problems with attention or thinking or focus or even memory problems, and those are distressing side effects and require also a real concerted approach. There is no single antidote that can be given here. There can be appetite loss. There can be problems with fluids getting behind in the fluids, problems related to diarrhea, perhaps dehydration. All of these can be managed medically and require very, very detailed follow-up. So if you find that you are getting a medication, for instance, that is really helping the cancer but is taking a toll, it's important also to provide at the time of the regularly scheduled appointments and perhaps even to call in and be very clear and specific about the physical impact of these treatments on the body. There can be problems with lymphedema, which is buildup of fluid, especially for women who've had many lymph nodes removed or who've had large surgeries and then have had radiation, and those also need to be treated by professionals so that they're hopefully caught early and the damage can be minimized. Many women who are getting chemotherapy or any form of targeted therapy also tell us they have dry mouth, they have sticky dry feelings or burning in the mouth. This can also be treated sometimes with medication, sometimes with saliva substitute and rinses. Menopausal symptoms we've discussed are very, very common for women, especially younger women who are facing these for the first time. And finally, one of the common side effects of many of the drugs used to treat breast cancer, most specifically the taxanes, is they cause neuropathy. And that can be very distressing. And despite many trials and many searches to find the right antidotes or perhaps herbs or supplements that can solve the problem, there's really been very little progress in that area. So we end up treating it with medications such as gabapentin or pregabalin. There is one medication that seems to help quite a bit, and that's a medication called duloxetine. It was studied in a clinical trial. Duloxetine is something to talk about and consider, but you have to watch out because there may be some drug interactions with other medications that are commonly used to treat breast cancer, such as tamoxifen. So I won't bore you with the very comprehensive list, but this is just a way of getting you perhaps to think about your own situation and if you are currently in treatment, to be very clear with your clinicians when you meet them of just how many of these symptoms or others you're experiencing, and if you can, also give them a detailed analysis of just how severe they are. Are they something that you think about all the time? Does it require a huge effort to bear it, or is it something that is so severe that you need to consider a change in treatment? So my last assignment was to discuss the key questions to discuss during office visits or between appointments. And my advice would be that I believe everybody needs to be really well informed and clear about the disease, the diagnosis, the intention of the treatment, the duration of the treatment. Perhaps you should ask yourselves, are there things I don't understand about my plan of care? And if that's the case, try to think about how you can bring that up at your next visit so that you really do feel that you are well informed and you're active and engaged in making treatment-related decisions. Maybe another question that you should ask is, are there other treatments I should consider? Yes, this seems to be going well, but perhaps there are clinical trials, there are exciting approaches to the same disease. Should I think about it now, or should I think about it as the next step? And then finally, I think it's always helpful to be discussing with your clinicians what's next. If you are just going to be followed and monitored, what's that going to look like? If you have to be in treatment, for an indefinite amount of time, will there be times perhaps where you can lighten up on your treatment or take a break? Or if the treatment you're currently using no longer helps you, what is the team considering as a next step? And that just gives you a little bit of extra time to prepare, perhaps to do some research, even to consult, and get other opinions about what you can do to live with your disease as well as possible and as long as possible. So I'm going to stop right there and turn it back to you, Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. That was really outstanding and very lots of information, very comprehensive. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next presenter is Allison Nielsen. Allison is an oncology social worker. She is our Cancer Cares Women's Cancers Program Director. And Ms. Nielsen is going to address Cancer Cares free psychosocial support services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Allison.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's really a privilege to be with you all today on today's workshop. As an oncology social worker, I work with many women and their loved ones who are coping with a diagnosis of breast cancer. I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're coping with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone impacted by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York City area and over the telephone nationally, support groups offered face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in the ways in which a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her world. They are experienced in helping cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the many problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you probably know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. If you've been diagnosed, you may feel the need to stay strong, keep smiling, or push away uncomfortable feelings. But even the strongest person can't always stay positive, and it's not really feasible to handle cancer all by yourself. The good news is that you do not have to walk the path alone. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of courage and strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about cancer. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice concerns and learn new ways to cope. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. And feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a support group over the telephone for women coping with metastatic breast cancer of all subtypes. There are also online support groups available for women with both early stage and advanced breast cancer. The next cycle of these groups will begin on June 1st. And women with cancer in the New York tri-state area can attend our face-to-face, in-person support groups. Other group members with HER2-positive breast cancer can offer valuable insight based on their personal experience. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our comprehensive website at www.cancercare.org. As we've learned a lot from today's HER2-positive breast cancer treatment update program, you may have some questions about what it means for you. Our oncology social workers can talk to you and guide you through the process. Know that you're not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you through. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Nielsen. That was wonderful and very supportive of everybody, and also providing a resource for everybody to utilize that's available and free. So I hope everyone on the line heard all this and will take advantage of these services. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Amanda to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call 1-800-813-4673, which is the Cancer Care's Hope Line, and our oncology social workers will be there to address your questions. But let's see if we can't take all of them, the ones that we have right now today on this call. So, Amanda, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Stephanie C. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for this wonderful seminar. I'm an 8-year breast cancer survivor of HER2, but I had non-hormonal double negative. I did have Herceptin and all the treatment, but I'd like to know, it's very important, I have several questions. I just want to know quickly, is there any other treatments for the non-hormonal part with the ER negative, PR negative? And secondly, when you have nodes removed and I have lymphedema, I had massage therapy, but is any talk about acupuncture for the lymphedema and also for peripheral neuropathy for alpha lipoic acid and vitamin B6? So I have several questions. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, actually, Stephanie, thanks for all those wonderful questions. Well, I think I'll have Dr. Grana start with your first question.
So for the woman who's ER-PR negative, there's no hormonal therapy utilized, and the fortunate thing for you is that you were HER2-new positive, so you got such a tremendous benefit from the Herceptin. Nothing else is recommended in terms of risk reduction. We don't recommend to these women that they take tamoxifen to protect the opposite breast, which we do if you were ER positive, so I would say you're done. 8 years out, I think it's, recurrences are remarkably, remarkably, remarkably unlikely. So I would say you need nothing, and you need to stay positive and focused.
Sounds good. Sounds excellent. Stephanie, that's wonderful information. And then also, Dr. Shapiro, would you want to address the other questions about the lymphedema and the peripheral neuropathy, and if you could address those questions in a general way?
Sure. So for lymphedema treatment, compression and manual drainage, or even using some pumps that use sort of electrical stimulation for drainage, is all that I know has been shown to work. The sleeves come in different sizes, and you need to be fitted by a special lymphedema therapist. Learning to do manual drainage is great, or having somebody do it for you is important. Whether or not acupuncture relieves lymphedema, I think, has not been proven. If it helps you for either the lymphedema or to treat the peripheral neuropathy, then if you derive a subjective benefit, I would certainly say that it's a good thing to continue, but I think there's no proof that we can recommend this generally to others. Many of the herbs and substances you have just mentioned have been studied, and unfortunately studies have not shown that they really are effective. That doesn't mean that they are not helping you. So I would say that if after 8 years you still have residual problems with peripheral neuropathy and you have found some way of dealing with your symptoms that you feel is helpful, then I would support the practice.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Maureen. If prone to GI issues, would the combo of drugs that result in GI toxicity be avoided? Dr. Shapira, could you address that question?
So it's a very good question, and I'm afraid that I cannot give a good answer here. It depends on what the choices are for treatment. So, for instance, for somebody who is prone to GI toxicity, if we have a choice between a drug that will and one that won't cause GI toxicity and we can expect the same level of benefit, we would choose the one without the GI toxicity. But in some situations, you know, we have to give it a try and see how it goes. Furthermore, not all women who are prone to GI toxicity manifest the same symptoms. So the question is a little bit general. I don't think that we can quite answer it in a way that will provide a lot of helpful information, you know, either to the individual asking or to the group here.
I totally agree with that. And I think the one thing you can do is just be more vigilant so that your team may watch you more carefully, have you come in more, have you get labs more, potentially start at a little bit lower dose. If you are giving someone Taxotere, carboplatin, Herceptin, and Perjeta, which is a common regimen that's used, or Taxotere and Perjeta, for example, you might start the first dose in someone who has had real problems like diverticulitis or other things, you might start at a slightly lower dose and bump it up. So it is something that can be individualized a little bit.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Another question from one of our online participants. With so many to choose from, how does my doctor determine which treatment to recommend? Now, I realize this is a very complex question, but I'm going to ask Dr. Grana and Dr. Shapira to weigh in on this one because it's an important question, and I know that it's something that people often are curious about. So
it depends a little bit on whether we're dealing with early-stage disease or with advanced disease. If you're dealing with early-stage disease, then there probably are three main regimens that your physician can choose from. And he, she is going to choose based on your health, your age, your cardiac status, whether he's willing to risk cardiac toxicity, which any adriamycin-containing cocktail has a higher risk of, or not. And it also is going to be based on the features of your cancer. I've been using, for these smaller cancers, a centimeter, HER2-new positive, I've been using a fair amount of the paclitaxel with Herceptin that was done at Dana-Farber, for example. So it's a little bit milder. I wouldn't use it for a node positive. So I think there's a certain amount of individual management that your clinician, if they're experienced, is going to know what to do. I think the discussion is much more difficult in metastatic disease because the choices are so many more, and there it much more goes into the individualization, and there are many good choices.
Thank you.
I agree completely, and thank goodness there are guidelines. So, for instance, there are guidelines that you can look at and the clinicians can look at that pretty much spell out the order of these treatments in most situations. And as Dr. Grana just said, in the adjuvant setting, it's sort of clear that we need to, you know, pursue certain combinations of drugs. Usually we use more drugs in that sense. In the metastatic setting, we try to use as little as we can to get the job done. And we're much more cognizant of trying to spare toxicity. But there are guidelines, there are treatment algorithms, so you don't have to worry that the oncologist is improvising. That should never happen. We usually use treatments that have been shown to work in large, well-designed, well-analyzed clinical trials. So our recommendations are usually based on comparing the situation at hand with situations that have been similar and that have been really very rigorously studied.
Awesome. Thank you. And there is another question here from one of our online participants. I've heard that this new drug, neratinib, did really well in clinical trials for HER2-positive breast cancer patients. Will this drug be on the market anytime soon? Dr. Shapira, could you address that in a general way?
Yes, of course. We don't know the answer to that question. Dr. Grana and I were chatting right before the conference. We are wondering the same thing. I asked my colleagues here this morning that same question, anticipating it would come up, and I'm afraid I don't have a timeline. We're all waiting anxiously to hear the answer to that.
And you know, if you go back to when Herceptin was first approved, Herceptin was approved, and we actually went back to women that had finished their chemotherapy within 6 months or so and gave them Herceptin, even though today we would give the Herceptin with chemotherapy. So even if the drug comes out later and you finished within a six-month period of time, there may still be a discussion to be had about this. So I don't think you should despair, but no, we have no idea.
Excellent. So stay tuned. And also, do we have thoughts about how people can stay tuned or what they can do in terms of getting that information or keeping up with everything?
Well, first of all, everything that's big in breast cancer tends to have two time frames. It tends to be near San Antonio in December or near ASCO in June. These are the two large meetings where a lot of data in the breast cancer field is presented, and it does tend to hit the media, especially things that will have an impact on a large number of patients. So stay tuned in June, see if anything comes out. Some things come out in Europe at a meeting called ESMO. Some things come out in September at another meeting in the U.S., so these tend to hit the media, but also there are some great sites where patients can stay informed, breastcancer.org, Living Beyond Breast Cancer, Young Breast Cancer Coalition. All of those do pieces where they review literature and cutting-edge things as they get presented. So I think the breast cancer community is very, very informed.
Excellent. Thank you. And there is another question from one of our online participants, Debbie. Is there any chance or research in the future that Herceptin will be given alone or in combination with other HER2 drugs without the other chemo drugs that have so many side effects? Dr. Shapira, could you address that question?
Yes, I think that's a beautiful question. We are all waiting anxiously to see if we can identify a group of women who don't need chemotherapy and who would just do just as well with perhaps a combination of targeted therapies, anti-HER2 therapies. And this is something that we have been thinking about and talking about at all the major meetings. We're moving slowly in that direction, but we're not there yet. So yes, I support the idea that behind the question, which is that it's really up to us to try to identify a group who don't need the more toxic chemotherapy drugs that we typically piggyback on to the HER2-directed therapies. But at the moment, we're not quite there.
Excellent. And there's a general question from Denise about mammograms. Is it true that a base mammogram should be done between the age of 35 and 37? So, Dr. Grana, could you address that? Because it is a question that people are always asking, like, when should they have their mammograms? And
I don't know that I've ever heard it that explicit, between 35 and 37. Typically, we think of having a baseline mammogram by age 40. And then, depending on who you read and who you believe, I'm a believer in yearly mammograms after 40. But there are plenty of people that argue and don't follow that metric. Again, I am biased, and I'm a believer in mammography yearly after age 40. You do, though, have to individualize this decision based on your family history and your risk. So the recommendations are to begin mammography 10 years younger than the youngest woman in your family to be diagnosed with breast cancer, and for women who are at hereditary risk, women who carry mutations in some of the breast cancer genes, to actually begin at 25. And between 25 and 30, there's some debate about whether mammograms or MRIs might be better. But I think the key is that the screening recommendations are affected by family history and other factors.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. So we have a question from one of our participants. What does my doctor mean when he says metastatic breast cancer isn't curable but is treatable? Dr. Shapiro, could you address that in a general way?
Sure. So metastatic breast cancer refers to cancer that has spread beyond the breast and the regional lymph node to other parts of the body. And today, with the treatments we have available, we can never make that completely disappear. We can make it shrink on scans. We can make it such that the patient doesn't feel anything, but we can't eradicate every last cell. So we think of it as a chronic illness, something that will require treatment indefinitely. So it's not curable in the sense that you can't just walk away from it. Eventually it'll show up, or it will always need to be treated in some way. So doctors have used this expression, it's not curable but treatable, to communicate to patients that it's a chronic illness, an illness that you'll have to live with forever, but that there are also many effective treatments that it can keep the disease under control so that on a day-by-day basis it really doesn't bother you very much.
Thank you. And we have another question. So I really appreciate our online community has been very active, and we certainly will be happy to take questions from those on the telephone as well. But from Karen, seems to be an increased use of Gemzar and carboplatin in metastatic HER2-positive with success. Any comment on this combo? Dr. Grana, could you address this?
That's actually not a combination that I use very much in HER2-positive disease. Others may. That's a combination that I use very commonly in triple-negative breast cancer because both drugs, carboplatin in particular, has lots of activity in triple-negative disease, in BRCA1-positive disease, and Gemzar is a drug that's often used with carbo, but that is not a regimen that I tend to use in HER2-positive metastatic disease. I tend to use agents such as Navalbine Herceptin, Gemzar Herceptin. I tend to be more on the line of single agents in combination with Herceptin rather than a lot of combinations when added to Herceptin.
Excellent. Thank you.
And Dr. Shapiro may feel differently.
No, I completely agree.
Excellent. So I keep having hot flashes at night that are making me lose sleep. Is there anything I can do to relieve them? So that's a question from one of our online participants. And I guess if we want to answer that, if everyone want to chime in on this one, because this is really important, and so I'm going to ask, I guess, Dr. Shapiro, Dr. Grana, and Allison as well, because it really does impact the quality of life, psychosocial functioning, everything really.
So I'm going to be a little tough right now. I said this to a patient this morning. I said hot flashes are really uncomfortable, but they won't kill you. So we need a little dose of perspective, too, and realize that hot flashes are part of natural aging for women and occur as a result of menopause. Typically, they may be exacerbated by some of the treatments we use, such as, say, drugs like tamoxifen, and certainly for women who have experienced menopause as a result of breast cancer treatment, it can feel like a real insult, just as they're trying so hard to get well. So the perspective is that they're uncomfortable, and we need to accept that a little bit, and we need to choose wisely when to intervene. So, for instance, if they're really disabling, if somebody is unable to sleep, unable to work, or can't get through the day, that's a reason for medical therapy. There are some non-medical or non-pharmacologic treatments. For instance, it's been studied that acupuncture seems to relieve hot flashes for some women. It's been studied that very vigorous exercise helps bear the hot flashes. Certainly opening windows, cooling the core with cold drinks, all of these things that perhaps our grandmothers used to do, even the fans that come to mind from the old ladies, are things that can be very helpful. For women who have such severe symptoms that sleep is interrupted, then we need to think about using medication to help sleep. That sometimes has been done, and it certainly has been researched for women with breast cancer, so medications such as Zolpidem, Ambien have been tried and used successfully, or medications that really do decrease the frequency and severity of hot flashes. The most common one is a drug called venlafaxine, also known as Effexor, developed as an antidepressant and studied very rigorously in this population of breast cancer survivors, showing a benefit over placebo. So that's one drug that we can try. And another is a drug called gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, a drug that we've discussed in these conferences also because it helps reduce the painful aspect of the peripheral neuropathy that often results from some of the chemotherapy drugs we use. In fact, there have been studies that have compared the use of gabapentin and venlafaxine, and it appears that there's almost an individual predisposition to derive a benefit from one over the other. In other words, what I'm trying to say, what I'll say it in simple language, is for some women, one drug works better than the other, and you don't know that until you try it. So my approach to this is to try to first have the patient work with me and journal her hot flashes, how often they occur, how long they last, and to rate them. And then together, if we decide we're going to try medication, to start the medication and, again, do some journaling and try to estimate how helpful that medication is for her. And if it is, then we continue it and we sort of think about it perhaps every 6 to 9 months and at some point try to taper and see if we can get away without them. That's a very long answer, but I think hot flashes can be mild or very severe, and the kind of treatment that we use depends a little bit on how they're experienced and reported by each individual woman.
And Dr. Krana, did you want to add to this?
Yeah, I thought that was excellent. I like the concept that you need to put it in the perspective of everything else that's going on. I do spend a fair amount of time trying to help the woman understand if she has triggers or things that she could modify in her life. If you read books about menopause, women have hot flashes and night sweats as normal parts of menopause, and there are things you can do. Exercise is actually probably one of the most important. Looking to see if caffeine and alcohol are your stressors and avoiding them. Seeing if there's some dietary patterns that make them worse. Obviously, stress can sometimes bring them on, and you can't avoid stress in life, but relaxation techniques, etc. So I spend a lot of time talking to patients about that, but it often is just, you know, these are serious lifestyle changes that you need to embark upon, and it's sometimes easier to think about a medication, but the medications are not without side effects.
Thank you. And I actually just want to comment also that really it depends also on where a woman is in her lifestyle, in her lifespan, actually, in terms of so some women may have experienced menopause already. Others, and if you could also comment on that as well, some may actually be experiencing it at a much younger age than they would have expected to. And does that impact just the experience with these hot flashes? If it's caused by any of the medications as opposed to someone who's going through a natural menopause by the dint of their age. Can you comment on that, Dr. Shapira?
Yes, I think that it has every single thing that you've said is important to consider. But at the end of the day, the reason they intervene with medication is because the patient tells you that she can't bear it. So whether she's very young or she's older, if she gets to a point where she really is asking for help, then I think that's when we think about using medications. We tend to think that it's worse for women who were not in menopause prior to cancer but have the cancer treatment resolved in menopause and then on top of it need to take hormonal agents. So it's as if their thermostat in terms of the production of estrogen is very quickly and dramatically brought down several notches. And maybe those are the women who need a little bit of help from us for a short period of time. But that said, you know, I can certainly think of many patients who have gone through all of these changes and seem to adjust with time, with some support and some coaching, without needing to use medication. So I think there's very variable. It's very variable. It depends a little on one's physiology and also on one's, ability to bear some of these uncomfortable symptoms.
And Allison, do you want to comment just from the groups and what we find helpful from working with the women who come here, just for their psychosocial support around these issues?
I'd just like to piggyback on what the doctors have said, that for many women undergoing treatment for breast cancer, the menopausal side effects can be bothersome. They can be hindering in some situations. I think it's really critical for women to know what's within the normal range for their own bodies. Everybody's different. But as the doctors have highlighted, certainly if these symptoms are impacting somebody's ability to function or their ability to carry on with daily activities, then it does become a quality of life issue that needs to be addressed. So if these menopausal symptoms are unusual, they're really ongoing, persistent, acute, that would be the time to have the open dialogue with your medical team to really see if there's some interventions that might give you a better outcome.
Excellent. Thank you. And there's one question, one other question here about from Kathleen. I was told that I would never be off treatment. I have been no evidence of disease for years and off treatment for 7 years. How would you describe this state? So, Dr. Groner, if you could just address this in a general way, because we don't have all the particulars.
I'm missing a piece of this. She has been without evidence of disease for 7 years.
For seven years.
Continues on treatment or is off?
No, I was told that I would never be off treatment, but I have been no evidence of disease for years and off all treatment for 7 years. How would you describe that
date? I would say that this is what I would call a cure, although, God, we tell people that we don't know if such a thing exists. In HER2-positive disease that's metastatic, we do see an increasing number of patients that achieve complete responses where everything that you can see disappears. And you follow these patients year after year with scans, and you don't see resurfacing of this. But most of us are too worried to stop the Herceptin or to stop the Perjeta and Herceptin if they're on combination therapy. So these women stay on drug indefinitely, and no one knows what the right answer is. No one knows whether you could go off drug because they're in effect cured or whether the drugs are keeping the disease in check. So it's an uncharted territory right now. Dr. Shapiro, I don't...
Yes, I do the same thing. I think that there are a few patients who at one point showed signs of having metastatic disease and then were put on this path of being on Herceptin indefinitely, and then all of that goes away and we continue year after year with the treatment without really knowing if we need to or not. But most of us, as Dr. Grana just pointed out, would favor continuing the treatment. So without knowing more details, I wonder if that may be the situation that this caller is describing.
And, you know, there are some people that are looking at vaccines in this population, not someone who's been 7 years off treatment, but in these women that achieve a complete response, there are folks that are looking at vaccines, HER2-new targeted vaccines, to see if it could sort of cement that response. But it's an uncharted territory right now.
So we do have more to await here, and we do encourage everyone here to stay tuned keep asking those questions. I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary today, and I want to thank all of you who've queued up and ask such wonderful questions, really they were your questions, but they actually help to enhance the call and allow our speakers to address topics that are of really great concern to each of you and that have relevance to everybody on the call. I do want to remind all of you this is part one. It's a part two, a treatment of estrogen receptor ER-positive and progesterone receptor PR-positive breast cancer and triple-negative breast cancer on May 27th. Many of you have signed up for that program. And I also want to let you all know that we do have a post-ASCO, highlights of ASCO workshop coming up. It's in your materials. And that program will occur on June 11th, and it will address a number of different cancers, including breast cancer and what's been reported at ASCO. So please stay tuned for that as well. You know, as we conclude the program today, I know that many times people feel alone in coping with breast cancer or in coping with cancer. And my hope is that after your connection with our program today, that you recognize that you really are connected with many different resources, cancer care being one of them. But you also have a listing of so many other organizations that are available for you to access information from and to actually call. And so in those moments when you are feeling particularly alone or when there's no one that you feel that there's to call, do call us. It's a free telephone call, 1-800-813-HOPE, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org, since many of you are from different parts of the world as well. We have wonderful oncology social workers here, and they are available to talk with you about your concerns. We offer practical and financial assistance. We offer counseling, a chance to talk to somebody. We have a number of different types of support groups here, both on the telephone and online, to make them accessible to all of you. We have these workshops and many publications. So there's a lot to choose from, and I would say that in those moments when you're feeling that you need someone to talk to, or even in those moments when you don't feel that way but anticipate that that could happen, do give us a call. We particularly are concerned about people really struggling out there on their own without any kind of awareness that there are these resources out there for them. And although Cancer Care is one of them, we've given you a listing of all the different cancer organizations out there as well, and we hope that they'll be of help to you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I look forward to your participation on our future programs, and I thank you all. Have a wonderful day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.